Mrs. Eddy by Hugh Studdard Kennedy. Chapter 45. Mark Twain. As far back as 1899, Mark Twain had fired his first gun at Christian Science and its founder in two articles which appeared in the Cosmopolitan magazine. The first, in the August issue, was entitled At the Appetite Cure, and the second, which appeared in October, Christian Science and the Book of Mrs. Eddy. There was nothing malicious in the articles, and as Mark Twain's biographer, Bigelow Paine, justly remarks, their delightful humor awoke a general laugh, in which even devout Christian Scientists were inclined to join. Mark Twain was willing to admit that Mrs. Eddy and her book had benefited humanity. But he could not resist the fun-making which, to his mind, her doctrine invited. Today, although worn rather thin in the light of subsequent history, the articles were still delightful clowning. No one knew better than Mark Twain how to build up an inference of his own into a solemn announcement by his opponent, and then use it to excellent purpose as a foil for some quite hilarious comment. His insistence that science and health could not, as he averred, Mrs. Eddy claimed, have been written by the Almighty, because no foreigner could secure copyright in the United States, is a case in point. Nothing, however, roused Mark Twain to more violent explosion than an issue quite impervious to his attacks. And there was something about Christian Science, especially about Mrs. Eddy, which he evidently found little short of exasperating. To him, one minute, Mrs. Eddy was easily the most interesting person on the planet, and in several ways as easily the most extraordinary woman that was ever born upon it. The next, she was a liar and a fraud, a crook, and a charlatan. Only once did Mrs. Eddy reply to him, in a letter to the New York Herald. One of the most difficult things to answer successfully is a clever satire. Humanly speaking, any engagement in kind must meet satire with more pungent satire, must, at every point, out-Herod Herod. Mrs. Eddy made no attempt to do anything of the kind. To Mark Twain's direct charges, she makes direct answers without heat or irritation. Mark Twain had lampooned her for being styled Mother by her followers. She says simply that she had begged them not to do so, but that the word spread like wildfire. And then she continues, I still must think the name is not applicable to me. I stand in relation to this century as a Christian discoverer, founder, and leader. I may be more loved, but I am less lauded, pampered, provided for, and cheered than others before me. To Mark Twain's implied charge that she regarded herself as a second Christ, she says that she considers self-deification as blasphemous. And his further charge, that if she does not regard herself as a second Christ, she certainly regards herself as a second Virgin Mary. she dismisses in few words. I have not the inspiration nor the aspiration to be a first or second virgin mother. Her duplicate, antecedent, or subsequent. What I am remains to be proved by the good I do. We need much humility, wisdom, and love to perform the functions of foreshadowing and forecasting heaven within us. This glory is molten in the furnace of affliction. But if Mrs. Eddy dismissed Mark Twain's attack thus briefly, there was among her followers one, at least, who thought it might be done more thoroughly. And when Mark Twain, in the early days of 1906, collected his articles together, added to them others not previously published, and issued the whole in book form under the title of Christian Science, Edward Kimball undertook to make reply in the Cosmopolitan magazine. His article appeared in the May issue and immediately attracted widespread attention, not only for the skill with which it dealt with Mark Twain and his book, but because of its simple yet masterly exposition of his concept of Mrs. Eddy's teaching. The problem before Mr. Kimball was a difficult one. Mark Twain was at the height of his popularity, and he was armed with the deadly weapon of satire, which no one in his generation knew better how to handle. Kimball himself admired Mark Twain immensely, and he made no effort to conceal his admiration. His line of attack, if so it should be called, is that of Mark Anthony. Brutus is an honorable man. They are all honorable men, is its underlying theme. And the effect in the case of Mrs. Eddy runs true enough to form. By the time he is finished with the honorable man and his friends, they seem somehow to have lost no little caste and importance. Mark Twain's objections were, in many respects, very human objections. When the pure fun-making in them had been eliminated, they were the objections of the man in the street. Edward Kimball's replies were very human replies. His opening sentence is certainly calculated to arrest attention. By way of justification, in part, of the Christian Science propaganda, he writes, the reader of this article is asked to consider for a moment the startling statement of fact afforded us by medical authority to the effect that of the 50 million people who die every year, one half die prematurely. It may be presumed that before dying, nearly all of these people tried to get well, and that in this effort they had recourse to some form of material means. Finally, it may be concluded that at least 25 million people die annually because of the insufficiency of material means to cope with disease. Having thus laid before the readers an incontrovertible statement, Kimball goes on to pay warm tribute to the grand men and women who, as medical practitioners, have struggled on through the fluctuations of success and failure, ever deploring the instability of medical theories and the inadequacy of material remedies. Thus, in two brief paragraphs, he laid before his readers what most people would be compelled to admit was a tragic need and the tragic inadequacy of the means so far devised to meet it. Christian Science, he insisted, had no quarrel with any man who sought by any means to meet so urgent a need. But it did lift its voice inquiringly to those who are dying and asks if they are doing the best that can be done to live in peace. There was, therefore, he went on, quite clearly room for another healing method. Indeed, there was an urgent call for one, and where the need was so great and the provision for help so utterly inadequate, it surely ill became anyone to heap contumely on a woman who had it in her heart to render what aid she could. Nearly 40 years ago, he writes, Mrs. Eddy proclaimed to the world certain postulates of a religio-scientific nature, and declared that the verity thereof can be demonstrated with scientific accuracy. She insisted that God, the sole creator of all that has actual, legitimate existence, has not created or procured disease and does not make use of it or cooperate with it for any purpose. She declared that sickness is an abnormality, wholly illegitimate, unlawful, and unnecessary, that it is not a natural, indispensable, or irresistible incident of man's normal experience. And finally, that sickness, being at most but a disorder of human procurement, can be and will be exterminated. And then, warming to his subject, he continues, she declared that the demonstrations of Jesus, instead of being works of mystery, were in attestation of the divinely scientific verity that the nature, power, and law of God are adequately available to a sick man and are spontaneously responsive to his need. To scientists, philosophers, and metaphysicians, she declared that the chief mischief-maker of the world and the primary cause or essence of disease is what Paul designated the carnal mind, represented by the sum of an aggregation of human fear, ignorance, superstition, sin, and erroneous and perverted beliefs and illusions. She declared that the one supreme potentiality of the universe is the divine mind or spirit, which correctly has been termed omniscience. And furthermore, that this mind, which was also in Christ, is equal to and is all that will ever affect the redemption of mortals from sin and sickness. If these things be true, then it follows that the verity thereof sanctions the unlimited hope and favorable expectations of everyone whose earthly sojourn is beset by disaster. A million people who have tested the truth of this science insistently bear witness that by its means they have been delivered from every form of disease, sin, vice, fear, and misery. Having thus presented his case and established in some degree an appreciation of the almost pathetic urgency of the situation, how in the presence of so great a need, such bitter hopes deferred and despair, any honest effort to bring help and comfort should not be met with derision and contumely. Kimball, evidently feeling that his readers were now with him, turns suddenly on Mark Twain. A man whose wit has been the object of a nation's admiration, a man who actually won his way to the generous affection of his countrymen by reason of his genial and unmalicious humor and good cheer. This man, whose mission in life was to tinge with gentle glow the rugged peaks of human existence, and, perchance, even to dry the tears of some who were being stung by the bitterness of man's inhumanity to man, comes with deliberate offensiveness to denominate Mrs. Eddy a liar and a fraud. Thence onwards, Kimball has an easy time of it. The reader is inclined to agree with him when he declares that there is a certain venerable staleness about Mark Twain's statement that Christian Scientists do not think, that they have no discriminating faculty, that they are the dupes of folly and duplicity, that they have no mental integrity, and that most of them are engaged in an unholy pursuit of money. He does not attempt to answer these charges, but comes quickly to Mark Twain's main theme, namely, that Mrs. Eddy did not and could not have written Science and Health. Here, Kimball is certainly at his best. Mr. Clemens has written a book, he says in conclusion, through which runs an unbroken thread of purpose to procure the discomfiture of Mrs. Eddy. In this behalf, he presents a riot of inconsistency which we may with propriety consider. In order to gain his point, he is obliged to present Science and Health as possessing some merit. Then he insists that Mrs. Eddy never rose to an intellectual altitude that was on a plane of excellence with the book. Then follows the deduction that she did not write it, and that her pretense is fraudulent. He thus used the book for the obliteration of Mrs. Eddy, an apparent disregard of the fact that in another place he has written, of all the strange and frantic and incomprehensible books which the imagination of man has created, surely this one is the prize sample. He declares that in several ways Mrs. Eddy is the most interesting woman that ever lived, and the most extraordinary. That she launched a world religion which is increasing at a rate of a new church every 4 days. that it is quite within the probabilities that she will be the most imposing figure that has cast its shadow across the globe since the inauguration of our era, that she is profoundly wise in some respects. She is competent, and so forth. And then he declares his conviction that she could not have written the most frantic and incomprehensible book which man has ever created. And this is the testimony of an expert. And so he rides to this finish. After concluding that the founder and leader of this religious movement is a fraud and a cheat and a tyrant, and that the textbook of this church is an unconscionable lie, that the church organization is venal, its laws outrageous, and its aims degrading, he declares, "I believe that the new religion will conquer half of Christendom in 100 years. And adds concerning this statement, "I think perhaps it is a compliment to the human race." It was not long before Mark Twain regretted it all very deeply. The man who suffered all his life, and especially in his later years, when he thought of the unkindness and cruelty inflicted by a man upon his fellow man, came to see that what he had done in his articles and in his book was something he would have condemned roundly in another. His biographer, Albert Bigelow Paine, records how one day, in conversation with Mark Twain, he referred to the matter and elicited a very unexpected comment. "I was at this period," Paine writes, "interested a good deal in mental healing, and had been treated for neurasthenia with gratifying results. Like most of the world, I had assumed from his published articles that he condemned Christian Science and its related practices out of hand. When I confessed rather reluctantly one day the benefit I had received, he surprised me by answering, 'Of course you have been benefited. Christian Science is humanity's boon. Mother Eddie deserves a place in the Trinity as much as any member of it. She has organized and made available a healing principle that for 2,000 years has never been employed except as the merest guesswork. She is the benefactor of the age." Mark Twain's fun-making, as far as Christian Science was concerned, remained for many years and still remains, but the sting has long since gone from it. There was, however, already developing, even before Mark Twain launched his satires, a far more deadly attack, and by a man of very different character. For several years, Joseph Pulitzer, the strange dynamic genius who had raised the New York World from a bankrupt sheet in 1883 to one of the most widely circulated newspapers in the United States by 1906, had been watching Christian Science and its founder. With that sure instinct for news, which helped to make him one of the outstanding figures in modern journalism, he saw from the first the news possibilities of Christian Science in general, and Mrs. Eddy in particular. A man of strong intellect, amazing ability, and insatiable ambition, he had in his latter years, when stricken with blindness, withdrawn from the world of men and women as far as his own personal appearance was concerned, but from the cabin of his yacht, or from some place of seclusion in the south of France, or the coast of Maine, he kept control of every detail of his great paper. And every day, and many times each day, some one of the small army of secretaries, always at his command, would cable instructions to New York as to what was to be dealt with prominently and how it was to be dealt with. He seems to have worked up to the conclusion that the Christian Science movement was a gigantic fraud, and that Mrs. Eddy, although in her day the high priestess of fraud, had in her later years simply become the tool of designing people. The tremendous stir created throughout the country by the dedication of the Mother Church evidently decided Pulitzer that he was right. Mrs. Eddy's absence from the scene of her triumph was something he found it difficult to understand, save on the assumption that she was incapable of being present. Her message, so he thought, anyone could have written. It was quite possible that she was sick and incapable, even mentally deficient, and that those around her in concord, in collusion with the church authorities, were keeping up the pretense of her leadership to further their own ends. She might even be dead. To be sure, report had it that she went out for a drive daily, but the carriage was a closed one, and it would be the simplest thing in the world for someone moderately resembling Mrs. Eddy to impersonate her. For Joseph Pulitzer, it was sufficient, it would seem, to conceive such a picture, to believe that it represented the true condition of affairs. Always he had had what he would have called a passion for the truth. And so it might justly be described, but the truth was the truth of Pulitzer's own determining. He was often right, far more often than not. And this perhaps makes no little excuse for him. But the fact remains that once he had made up his mind as to what should be regarded as the verities of a situation, nothing could change him. Facts might prove to be against him. But if so, then so much the worse for the facts. No one knew better than did Joseph Pulitzer how to get facts to prove his case. And so, in the summer of 1906, when everyone was talking of Mark Twain's book, as his yacht was cruising off the coast of Maine, Pulitzer seems to have formulated a plan for an attack on Mrs. Eddy and the Christian Science hierarchy, for so he would have called it, the like of which had never been attempted before. The world never did anything in a small way, and the world would show the world how exposures should be made and misdemeanants brought to justice.